Hello, and thank you for tuning in to Wellness Wednesday. Today we're airing an interview that was originally recorded on Friday, January 15th. This means that we didn't have the chance to discuss any COVID-19 advancements from Friday, January 15th to today with our experts. If you have any questions about accurate, timely case counts, vaccine distribution, or anything else that we cover in this episode, please visit ykhc.org, covid19.alaska.gov, or email me at lelle@kyuk.org. You're listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Hello, everyone, and welcome to Wellness Wednesday. I'm Alyssa Lachlan, your host, and today I am joined by...
My name is Dr. Joe McLaughlin. I'm the chief of the Alaska Section of Epidemiology and the state epidemiologist.
And I'm Dr. Ellen Hodges. I'm the chief of staff at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation in Bethel, Alaska.
Hi, Tammy Covered, public health nurse at the Bethel Public Health Center.
Great. Thank you guys so much for being here today. So just to go over the topics that we're going to be speaking about today, we're going to go over the YK and state case counts of COVID-19. We're going to go over vaccines, safety measures, and how we can take care of ourselves and others during the pandemic, especially during the winter.
Sure. And yeah, so just want everybody to know today is Friday, January 15th. And so as of today, what we've got this morning on our website is statewide, we've had 49,535 cases. We've had 1,126 hospitalizations and 227 fatalities statewide. In terms of the Bethel census area, we've had 2,875 cases that have been reported in to the Alaska Division of Public Health, and 44 hospitalizations and 12 fatalities.
And what sort of factors have led to the high case numbers that we're seeing in the YK Delta and the rest of the state of Alaska?
Sure. You know, I think one of the things that I think will be most important for folks to be aware of is what's been happening with respect to the trends in cases. I think as most people know, Alaska had very low incidence of COVID throughout the spring and the early summer months, and then our incidents really did start picking up during the summer months. And we did have a peak that really occurred in November and early December. And I'm just pulling up the dashboard now so we can take a, well, this is a radio show, so we're not gonna be able to take a look at this together. But yeah, so, you know, early December is when we peaked statewide. And since then, we've had a pretty precipitous decline in the cases. And only over the last, you know, week or couple of weeks have we kind of plateaued or leveled off. And in some cases, we've actually seen a bit of an increase again in cases. And I know in the YK census area, our decrease kind of followed the statewide decrease, but then we had a pretty sharp increase towards the end of December and then a slight decrease, but more of a leveling off. So what's happening? I guess that's the big question. You know, in terms of what led to the big decrease since early December, there were a few things. Number one, the municipality of Anchorage put in some emergency orders that I think really made a difference, at least in Anchorage, which, you know, a lot of our count, you know, a lot of our statewide counts are driven by what's happening in Anchorage. And so when we started to see that decline in cases in Anchorage, that really affected our statewide numbers. But also a lot of people come through Anchorage and may bring COVID out into more rural or remote areas of Alaska. And so when you see a decrease in incidence in our population hub, which is Anchorage, that's gonna impact what's happening statewide as well. Also, the governor did put out a text message to all Alaskans around that time when we were peaking. And I think that helped raise awareness and, you know, for people who maybe were not as inclined to follow the mitigation strategies, maybe that helped push them a little bit more towards following the mitigation strategies, which we know work for COVID. The main mitigation strategies are masking, wearing a mask whenever you're around people outside of your household. Number two is distancing, just keeping that 6 foot distance. That is still something we highly recommend that folks do. And then of course, avoiding crowds or any type of social gathering, either with friends or coworkers or whoever it is. We really want to avoid that from happening. And then lastly, just hand washing. So we're strongly recommending that people continue to follow those mitigation strategies.
We did see or have been noticing over the past few days an increase in cases associated, we think, with holiday get-togethers. And Slavic is just ending. So we expect to continue to see an increase in our numbers. For example, over the last couple of days, we reported a sharp increase in our cases.
So Dr. Hodges, I know that we had a decline after our month-long lockdown, but you're saying you believe that the current trend that's slightly upwards is due to holiday gatherings?
Yeah, certainly we saw an increase in hospitalizations shortly after the holidays, and that trend has continued. And also we've noticed an increase in cases overall. Based on case contact investigation, we believe this is associated with holiday get-togethers, including religious celebrations related to Slavic.
I would agree with that. And it's something that we certainly were quite worried about around the holidays. I think a lot of Alaskans really went out of their way to make sure that they decreased their regular gathering size as much as they could. And we're not seeing statewide as big of a uptick in cases as we had expected. But certainly in some regions, we are seeing a pretty abrupt uptick, like in the YK.
Something that is important in finding out whether there's an increase is testing. And testing is really important, and we encourage everyone to get tested as often as they can. Why is it important that people continue to get tested throughout the winter, even if they're not seeing others?
Great. Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a really important one. And I really want to underscore that testing is still something that we strongly recommend for anybody who has any signs or symptoms of COVID. And remember that COVID can look just like a common cold. It can look like influenza. And oftentimes people have very mild symptoms, especially in the beginning. It can just be a mild cough or a low-grade fever. Sometimes people will present with loss of taste or smell as well. But the importance of getting tested is, there are a few reasons why it's important. Number one, getting a positive test result actually helps people psychologically sort of get behind the idea of isolation. So it results in better compliance with isolation. If you know that you're positive and you get a call from public health saying you're positive, here's what we expect of you for during the isolation period, people tend to be more compliant. Number two, it helps facilitate contact tracing and better compliance with quarantine. So, if people know that they have a positive test, that can result in them being contacted by public health and then eliciting who their close contacts were during their infectious period, and then facilitating communication with those close contacts, making sure that those close contacts know that they need to be in quarantine.
So I agree with everything Dr. McLaughlin said. We are strongly encouraging anyone with symptoms to immediately isolate and get tested as soon as possible after that. That's a very important tool in our control of the pandemic. Also, we are asking everyone who has been recommended to quarantine to also get tested. So we're recommending testing at least once in the quarantine period, and at any time in the quarantine period, if an individual develops symptoms, we want them to immediately isolate and get tested. And then we're asking people that are in quarantine as well to get tested at least once and sometimes twice, depending on the circumstances and where they are and their method of exposure. This includes people who are household contacts of known positives. Those individuals may be asked to test twice, once upon diagnosis to identify if they're an index case themselves, and then maybe once towards the end of quarantine to make sure that they did not get infected during that time period. So that's kind of what we're recommended here for testing. We have testing open here in Bethel. every day of the week, Monday through Friday from 2 to 5. Anyone can just walk up and get tested if they would like to get tested. We have testing at the airport where we meet every single flight that comes in to test all of our incoming passengers. And for village-based clinics, just call your community health aide and schedule testing, and every village clinic has testing as well.
Great, that's really good to hear. So get tested, everyone. This is a question for you, Dr. Hodges, about the vaccines and just an update on what it looks like in the YK Delta right now. As of today, Friday, February 15th, how many people in the Delta have been vaccinated?
So as of today, 3,663 individuals have been vaccinated. Of this, about 2,200 of them are in our villages. And we are continuing to offer vaccine in sort of a prioritization method. So the initial wave from the state of Alaska was 1A, tiers 1, 2, and 3. This included our healthcare workers, as well as individuals who reside in long-term care facilities and assisted living facilities. We finished up that tier some time ago, but we are continuing to offer this vaccination to individuals in that tier if they've changed their mind and wish to become vaccinated at this point in time. People can call the 6949 number if they're a healthcare worker to get scheduled, 543-6949, and we will work on getting them scheduled. We were able to, fortunately, because of allocations from the Indian Health Service, open up vaccinations a little more widely than other parts of the state. So we are currently in Bethel vaccinating those aged 50 and older and individuals who are frontline essential workers. In order to get vaccinated for that, there's an online form to complete that you can reach at our website, ykhc.org. And once you've completed that form and you are in an eligible group, we will reach out to you and get you scheduled. For our village-based listeners, anyone aged 16 and older is eligible for vaccination, and we would also ask that you complete that online form as well, or you can call your clinic. We understand that not everybody will have access to complete that form, so you can also call 6949, 543-6949, and someone can help you complete that form or figure out a way to get you scheduled.
What is the difference between Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, if there is a big difference?
So they're both messenger RNA vaccines that work in very similar ways. They have similar side effect profiles and similar mechanisms of action. The main difference that people will notice is that for the Pfizer vaccine, which requires 2 doses, they have to be 21 days apart. And for the Moderna vaccine, they have to be 4 weeks apart or 28 days apart. The other thing about it that people might not notice as much, but we certainly notice, is the Pfizer vaccine has to be stored at minus 70 degrees and is a little fussier about being diluted and being transported. So we are primarily using our Pfizer vaccine for our Bethel-based folks and those villages that we can reach easily by driving. For Moderna, we're using that mainly for our village-based folks. They have similar efficacy and a similar side effect profile. So in all other ways, they're very similar and work in very similar ways. It's just sort of the ease of delivery to villages and the ease of diluting them. The Moderna vaccine doesn't require to be diluted, for example. So that's a little bit easier to use in our villages.
Both the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines that are available for YK listeners at the moment are mRNA vaccines. Dr. McLaughlin, would you mind explaining for our listeners what an mRNA vaccine is?
So first of all, just in general, vaccines essentially instruct our immune system to develop antibodies and protective cells to fight off viruses and bacteria. Now, these mRNA vaccines instruct our immune cells to actually make the spike protein, which is the protein that's found on the surface of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And they do this by basically sending in a little instruction code, and that's that mRNA that gets into the cell. And then once it's in the cell, the cell's machinery basically uses that code, that instruction code, to make these spike proteins. And then the spike proteins will be displayed on the surface of our cells, some of our cells in the body, like our immune cells. So they actually display this protein on their surface. And then our immune system recognizes that protein as being foreign. It doesn't belong in our body. And then our immune system begins to build up in what we call an immune response, such as making antibodies to the protein and actually making having other cells that are specific sort of fighter cells that fight off the virus. And this really mimics what happens in natural infection when somebody's infected with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So after these spike proteins are made, our cells actually get rid of the instructions. So it's, you know, they're not going to be constantly making these instructions. It's only for a small limited time. And that at the end of the process, our bodies have learned how to protect against future infections with the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Now, the benefit of mRNA vaccines, like all vaccines, is that those people who are vaccinated gain this protection without ever having to risk the serious consequences of getting sick with COVID-19.
How much protection can people expect after receiving their first dose of the vaccine versus receiving their second dose of the vaccine against COVID-19?
First of all, how long does it take before a person is actually considered to be immune? What we say is it's typically about 2 weeks after that second dose. So you're not going to be protected until, you know, for the Pfizer vaccine, you've got to get that first dose, then you wait 3 weeks to get the second dose, and then you wait another 2 weeks to get full immune protection. And then with the Moderna, it's the first dose, then 4 weeks, and then another 2 weeks. So it's 5 or 6 weeks, depending on which vaccine you get. There's some questions about, well, how much protection do I get after the first dose? We don't really know. It's probably at least 50%, but you really, really need that second dose. That second dose gives you a booster effect. It helps really improve the antibody response to that foreign particle, but it also probably plays a role in helping another arm of our immune system get ramped up. And so it's very, very important that people get that second dose.
And why is it that people must get two rounds of these mRNA vaccines, whereas with some vaccines, there's only one dose that must be taken for immunity?
Yeah, thanks for that. So most vaccines actually require a booster dose, but some do not. There's actually one vaccine that's in clinical trials right now made by Johnson & Johnson. This is a COVID vaccine that they're hoping will just be a one-dose vaccine, but actually they've just extended the clinical trial to include a second booster dose as well to see how people do with that second booster dose. So with these mRNA vaccines, yes, it does require a second booster dose. That's the way the vaccine appears to work best. And it's really going to not only increase the antibody response that people have to the vaccine, but it will also probably play a very significant role in boosting what we call a T cell immune response as well. So that's why you need that second dose.
I actually like to describe the vaccine and the booster a little bit. Someone described it to me like this. It's a little bit like you show your immune system a picture of the bad guy, like a lineup of the bad guy. Hey, this is the bad guy. Go kill this bad guy. This is a bad actor. We don't want this in our body at all. And the booster is a reminder dose. This is the bad guy. Go get this bad guy. So you really need both of those doses to be absolutely sure that your immune system is responding to it. So just think of it. I'd like to think of it that way. Like it's like a lineup in the police lineup. And this is the bad guy. Kill the bad guy. Now we're really sure this is the bad guy. Go get him.
Yeah.
Or her.
Great. I really like that analogy. How effective are these two COVID vaccines at preventing disease in the person who receives them? And also, how effective are they at preventing disease transmission to others?
So we know that these vaccines are highly effective. They're about 95% effective, which is quite remarkable. Just for reference, the flu vaccine on any given year is anywhere from 40 to 60% effective. And we really love that flu vaccine and getting it out to people. So to have a vaccine that's 95% effective is remarkable. What is it effective at? We know that it's effective at preventing COVID, which is the actual disease that people get when they're infected with the virus. So if you have any signs or symptoms, that's COVID. So we know it prevents signs and symptoms. It prevents the disease. But does it actually prevent infection? The answer is we don't know for sure. We're very hopeful that it does prevent infection, but we until we know, we just have to say, we don't know. So what could that mean if it doesn't prevent infection? That could mean that people who are vaccinated could still get infected with the virus. The vast majority are not going to develop any symptoms, but they could potentially have enough virus in their system to transmit it to others. We're very hopeful that that's not going to be the case, but we don't know for sure. And so that's why it's important, until we really understand the science better, for everybody who's fully vaccinated to continue to follow those mitigation strategies that we've discussed. Masking, staying at least 6 feet away from others, avoiding crowds, avoiding people outside of your household, things like that.
Great. Dr. Hodges, did you have anything to add?
No, I know that's an excellent description of it, but we do strongly recommend that people get vaccinated. And I think Dr. McLaughlin hit on this. And because we know, based on some of the studies that were done on these vaccines, that it does decrease your risk of severe COVID quite significantly. I believe only one person in both of the vaccine studies got severe COVID after vaccination, if they were in the active arm of the study. And it may decrease your risk of contracting COVID-19 at all. And we really need that to happen, especially because of our high case rates in our region right now. But we do know for sure it reduces your risk of severe COVID. And so those, especially who are listening, who are vulnerable, perhaps elderly, those with chronic health conditions, or maybe you have a vulnerable elder in your home. Those are the people that we really need to get vaccinated so that we can definitely reduce that risk of severe COVID. And we have seen a lot of severe COVID in our region.
Yeah, and I think it's important to underscore what Dr. Hodges is talking about. So the vaccine is 95% effective at preventing COVID. So 95% chance that you're not going to have any symptoms at all if you get infected. But 5% of people will still have what we call susceptibility, and they're susceptible to, quote, breakthrough disease or getting COVID, even though they've been vaccinated. So it's a small proportion, just 5%. But if you do wind up getting COVID, if you've been vaccinated, it's very likely to be an attenuated course of illness. In other words, a much milder course of illness, and your risk of hospitalization and death is much, much lower if you've been vaccinated. That's what we're expecting.
Dr. Hodges, are there any side effects of the COVID vaccine? What do they look like? And how can listeners expect to feel after receiving their first and their second doses?
That's a really great question. There's definitely side effects. Probably the most common side effect is pain at the injection site. Your arm's going to be sore where you got the shot. It's going to hurt a little. And in some cases, there may be some redness near that site and some swelling. People have experienced muscle aches, joint aches, fevers, headaches, chills. This is a little bit more common after the second dose than the first dose. They're very self-limited, meaning they last only 1 or 2 days and they kind of resolve and can easily be treated with over-the-counter medications such as ibuprofen or Tylenol or acetaminophen. A little ice pack maybe on your arm if it's particularly painful. So those are kind of the more common side effects we've seen. There are more serious effects that we know of from the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines, these anaphylactic reactions or severe allergic reactions. Fortunately, in the YK Delta region, in the vaccines that we've distributed, we have not yet experienced any of those severe allergic reactions among any of our recipients. There have been some in Alaska, but just none in our region.
Yes, so there actually was a very nice article that was published in CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. And this came out last week, entitled Allergic Reactions, Including Anaphylaxis After Receipt of the First Dose of the Pfizer Vaccine. And in this report, they basically summarize a total of 21 cases of anaphylaxis that had been identified during December 14th through the 23rd. And so this was after just shy of 2 million doses had been administered nationwide. And so basically it's 11 cases per million doses of vaccine administered. So it's a very rare event. And 71% of these cases occurred within 15 minutes of vaccination. And in all cases, people were able to get treated and, did just fine eventually. But it is important to underscore that anaphylaxis is a serious adverse event. But we do have good treatment available for anaphylaxis. And that's why it's so important with these vaccines and most other vaccines for folks to follow the guidance and stay in proximity, close proximity to your healthcare provider, whoever administered that vaccine, for at least 15 minutes. And if you're at higher risk for an adverse reaction, then the recommendation is to stay for 30 minutes just to make sure there's no anaphylactic reaction that occurs. But again, it's very rare, 11 cases per 1 million doses administered nationwide.
Let's move on to preventative measures and ways that we can kind of still curb COVID-19. Why is it important to wear a mask in public spaces, even if we've received the vaccine already?
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit. We still don't know if people who have been fully vaccinated could still be infected with the virus and potentially could transmit it to others. We also know that people who have been fully vaccinated, not everybody's going to have full protection against COVID. We said that it's 95% effective, which means that 5% of people are still susceptible and could get COVID. And so that's why those two reasons are why it's important, at least for the time being, for folks who've been fully vaccinated to continue to mask up, do the social distancing, washing hands, avoiding crowds, things like that.
Great, thanks. And Dr. Hodges, with the colder winter months, outside gatherings are pretty difficult. And since we're still encouraged to be in lockdown here in the YK Delta, it's important not to gather inside as well. So why shouldn't people be gathering indoors with people from outside of their household?
That's a great question. And it's mostly to decrease the risk of transmission. So when you're indoors, even if you're wearing a mask, there's always a higher chance of transmission than if you're out of doors. So being involved indoors with limited airflow and multiple peoples from different households, this just represents a huge risk of transmission. So we're asking people really to just to not gather indoors. We just think that that's a really important aspect of this. Outdoor gatherings with proper gear and good intentions, if you're staying 6 feet apart. Alaska in the winter, you need to get outside. You need to experience the wonderfulness of our region. But we're asking you, try to avoid people, try to stay only with your household, stay 6 feet away from everyone else, and wear masks. I mean, that's just really, really an important part of the controlling our pandemic.
Are there any mitigation efforts that either of you can think of to prevent COVID-19 transmission besides wearing masks and not gathering? What are some of the other ways we can protect ourselves and others?
Well, we talked about hand washing. That still is an important mitigation strategy. If I'm sick with COVID and I cough on this table in front of me, and you come up and put your hand on that table and then touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, you're probably going to get infected with COVID. So we want people to be washing their hands, especially when they're touching frequently touched surfaces. So that's also an important mitigation strategy. And I know in some areas that's not as easy as others. And so it's really important to do what you can with respect to hand washing and be as vigilant as you possibly can. And also, cleaning these high touch surfaces frequently, whether it's in a workplace or in any other gathering area. I think those three things of masking, social distancing, staying away from crowds and people who are outside of your household, and washing your hands, if you adhere to those, those are real easy to remember. They're just four simple mitigation strategies. If you adhere to those four things, your risk of COVID, acquiring COVID, as well as transmitting COVID, goes down tremendously.
Thank you. And while I know it's really important that we're all following these guidelines, I know that it also can be really, really hard. The isolation from our family and our friends can take a huge impact on our mental health, but also on our physical health. Tammy, would you like to touch on how listeners can stay active while they're in quarantine and isolation?
Yes, thank you. While we're inside, there's a lot of things to do. I especially hear this from parents for the children. And if they have access to good internet, there's a lot of YouTube videos out there that have really fun kind of like dance exercises and games that the kids can watch and participate in. But we hear a lot that there's confusion that if there's lockdown or quarantine, that they absolutely cannot go outside. And that's not true, but we want you to be in the mindset that if you go outside for fresh air and sunshine, that you are in quarantine outside still. So you cannot be around people, especially if you're walking or the kids are running. I would increase that 6 feet to a much greater distance, especially absolutely nobody outside of the home. And it was interesting. I was speaking with a father a couple of weeks ago from a village, and he said that the way their village was handling it was they were designated 2-hour slots. And he told me it was so wonderful because the whole family had grabbed their masks, and they, you know, walked straight from their house out into the tundra, and they had their 2 hours of playtime. And then the whole family, you know, masked up, came back, and they didn't interact with anybody, and they went back in their house. But, you know, the kids were playing, and they were getting fresh air and sunshine. And that's super important for us, for our mental health, our physical health, to get that fresh air and sunshine. So, and if, you know, anybody has a question and they think, well, can I do this? You know, please call and we can talk about it and, you know, we'll talk it through. And another thing I was thinking of, I don't know if anybody has Twister anymore, but there's a lot of games that you can have the kids do that are, they use a lot of core strength and muscles that you don't really think about. And Twister was one of those. So, yeah, parents are getting really creative and we applaud them for doing that.
Thanks, Tammy. Do you have any other suggestions for indoor activities besides Twister and things like dancing to keep our heart rate up and to keep active while we have to stay indoors?
Sure. Gosh, you can almost use anything. Like, I'm probably older than a lot of people, but I can remember stepping was a big thing when I was like in my 30s. And all you do is take a box or something and put it on the floor and then step on, step off, step on, step off. But if you do that long enough, that can really make a difference. And for the kids, you know, gosh, jumping jacks can be fun if you make it a contest. You know, anything that kind of makes it a game, they usually kind of really engage.
That's a good idea. I think I'm going to have to try that with all of the boxes that we have in our house. We have so many. So Dr. Hodges, even if we're taking all of these preventative measures, COVID is really tricky, and sometimes people can still be infected despite taking all of these preventative measures. What should we do if someone in our household is exposed to or diagnosed with COVID?
Sure, that's a really great question. So it sort of has two parts. So if you have a person in your household who's diagnosed with COVID, that's a little bit different than if someone's just exposed to COVID. So here, if you have a person in your household who's been diagnosed with COVID, the first thing you should do is try to wear masks in your house at all times. So just get everyone in the house in masks. Normally we don't require masks within the same household, but there have been some studies that have shown, and we have seen this anecdotally here in the Delta, that if you wear masks up and you're real careful in the house, you can sometimes prevent transmission from different household members. The other thing is to see if that person could be isolated from the rest of the household, whether they could be put into a bedroom by themselves or into a room by themselves away from the rest of the house. As much as possible. We understand that's not going to be possible in many of our houses, and especially if it's a child, that's very difficult to do. But if you can, that would be ideal, if you can isolate that person from the rest of your household. And then everyone needs to quarantine. No one needs to leave the house. You can't go anywhere. You got to rely on external help for your groceries and for all the other things. And there's lots of resources available in our communities to help you out there. And again, we'll be asking you to test. So pay attention to what our contact tracers from YKHC, from the Office of Environmental Health and Engineering, they're gonna be reaching out to you and follow their quarantine and testing recommendations. If someone's been exposed in your household but isn't tested positive, our recommendations are really gonna vary. Generally speaking, if you can't isolate yourself from that person and you kind of live in a setting with lots of people in the house, we may ask everyone in the house to quarantine together if someone in the house has been exposed. We may ask just the exposed person to quarantine, just the close contact to quarantine. If the person is a critical infrastructure worker and works in lives in a household with an exposed person, we may have them have a slightly different or modified quarantine. And so the most important thing is it can vary a little on our recommendations based on where you live and who was exposed, but follow the directions of the public health workers from the Office of Environmental Health and Engineering who are going to be reaching out to you, and they're going to work with you and give you specific instructions on who needs to quarantine and for how long if you have a close contact in your household. But again, if you have a person who tested positive in your household, that's slightly different. And everyone who lives in the household is considered a close contact. And it's absolutely essential that all those individuals quarantine and get tested as recommended. And if you're worried, if you have a person who was exposed in your household, we're happy to test anyone that lives in that household as well, even if that person wasn't positive. So again, that's another thing to keep in mind. Even though you're not officially on quarantine, we're happy to test everyone in that household. And it is a little confusing, and lots of different circumstances come up, and we just work closely with the OEHE folks to get sorted out what your appropriate quarantine is.
So if people have questions, what are some of the resources? Where can they reach out to get answers about how they should be quarantined and isolating?
That's a great question. If you're worried or you don't know, everyone should quarantine. That's the safest thing to do. So stay in your house, don't go out. And our Office of Environmental Health and Engineering will be calling to go over things. If you haven't heard from them, you can go ahead and call the 543-6949, which is our hotline number, and let them know that they haven't quite gotten to you yet. And we can reach out individually to give specific advice on quarantine. So the safest thing, everyone quarantine. Don't leave the house, don't have any interactions with anyone else, and await further instructions.
It can be really difficult, especially socially. It can be scary when you have to isolate in your room, speaking from personal experience. What are some things that we can do to kind of care for our loved ones and our housemates when they have a potential diagnosis or a diagnosis?
So we have a lot of things that we recommend. So for one, most people have cell phones. So go ahead and call your loved ones. You can talk to them on the phone. The COVID virus isn't transmitted over the phone. So just reach out to them and talk to them. And offer support and empathy, because it's really hard to quarantine. It's hard to isolate. It's hard to quarantine. It's lonely. And people feel ostracized maybe even a little bit from their family and their friends. So just reaching out and making sure they feel supported. And everyone knows it's a hard thing, and just offering a lot of support. But we also want to check on their health. So just making sure you reach out and check on their health as well. And also, one of the most important things about staying in isolation, if you're sick or in quarantine, if you've been exposed, is it's hard to do your activities of daily living. You can't get your mail, you can't get your groceries easily, and some people can't do their subsistence activities. So just reach out and offer to assist with those things. It's a pain. Maybe ask them if they need you to do a grocery run, or get them a special treat, or help them check their nets, or whatever it is that they need to have done during this time period, so that they can safely stay in quarantine. Because I think it's hard to be in quarantine. You think, oh, a quick trip to the post office can't hurt anything, but you know, it really might. So just figure out a way to get their keys and help check their mail. That's one of the ways that we as a community can really support everyone who has to be in isolation and quarantine. I know that when I had to be in quarantine after travel, I had a friend who dropped by a bouquet of flowers, and it really uplifted my day and helped make things really nice. So just reach out and try to do those little things, and dropping things off, of course, in a non-contact way. So drop it off on the porch, give them a text message, let them know that it's there, and go on. So those are some of the things that we can do to help each other, because it's lonely and isolating, and just make sure you reach out to them.
So another question about taking care of family members who are positive: what are some ways to treat mild COVID symptoms at home?
So a couple of things, getting really good supportive care. So increasing fluids, getting plenty of sleep, eating a pretty healthy, balanced diet. That's the basis for any sort of control or helping people with COVID symptoms. Tylenol, acetaminophen, or ibuprofen for mild discomfort and fever is really, really useful. And we also dispense, in most cases, a recovery kit for people who have COVID. And in the recovery kit is a way to measure your oxygen level. And so when you receive daily calls from our contact tracing team, they're going to want to know your oxygen saturation level. So if you do not receive a recovery kit, we want to hear from you so that we can get one dispensed to you so that we can follow your oxygen levels. We have noticed that some people, even young people who are getting sick from COVID, the first thing that happens is their oxygen saturation levels start to drop a little bit. And those are the people we get worried about and want to kind of see in our emergency room. Everyone else, it's really just supportive care at home. Avoiding high doses of vitamins and over-the-counter medication is really important. We've heard some people taking really exceptionally high doses of things like vitamin D or vitamin C or zinc. Those are just not safe. So just avoid high doses of medications. If you want to take a regular over-the-counter vitamin, that's probably okay. But there's really no reason to take high doses or mega doses of vitamins, and it may be harmful. So really, unfortunately, this is one of those viruses that there's not any specific medication for it while you're sick with it. And you really kind of got to stick to the old standbys of getting plenty of rest and plenty of fluids.
There's a lot that's still up in the air, especially with the new strains of COVID that have been discovered in South Africa and England. Dr. McLaughlin, would you mind touching on what those new strains are and what they mean for us?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So first of all, I just want to start out by saying that viruses constantly change, and they change through what we call mutation. And that is where their genetic code, whether it's a DNA virus or an RNA virus, those genetic codes get little changes to them that can impact the way the virus or the bacteria behaves in the human body and how it impacts our human health. So these new variants are expected to occur over time. We know that the coronaviruses tend to mutate not quite as rapidly as influenza viruses, probably about a third as fast as influenza viruses. And everybody knows that they have to get a new influenza vaccine every year. And that's because there's always this change that's happening with influenza viruses that are circulating. And so we want to make sure that people have the most up-to-date immune response to any circulating influenza viruses. And that's going to probably be the case for COVID going forward in the years ahead. So right now, there are multiple variants that are circulating globally. The one that probably most people have heard about is the United Kingdom strain. And this is a new variant called B117. And it has emerged with an unusually large number of mutations. So we've got a lot of mutations with this particular strain. The variant spreads more easily and more quickly than other variants. We know that to be the case, probably about 50% more efficient at spreading than the previous strain. So that's quite a change. And it's something that is definitely worrisome. Currently, there's no evidence that it causes more severe illness or any increased risk of death. And so that's good news for sure. The variant was first detected in September of 2020, and it's now highly prevalent in London as well as Southeast England, and will probably soon be the predominant strain throughout England. It's since been detected in a number of countries around the world, including the United States and Canada. Last I checked, there were about 11 states that had this B117. I was on a national call earlier this week, and the CDC folks who are really looking closely at these different strains suggested that this B117 strain could become the predominant strain in the United States as early as potentially this spring. And so we'll be watching that one very closely. There's also a South African strain that many people may have heard about. This variant is called 1.351, and it's emerged independently of the UK strain. And it was originally detected in early October, and it shares some of the mutations with the variant that we've detected in the United Kingdom. There have been cases caused by this variant outside of South Africa, but it hasn't been detected yet in the United States. There's also a new strain that's emerged from Brazil, and this is a variant called P.1, and that was first identified in 4 travelers from Brazil who were tested during routine screening in Tokyo, Japan. And this variant contains a set of additional mutations that could affect its ability to be recognized by antibodies. And so that could mean that people who are fully vaccinated or who have been infected with a previous strain could have a slightly decreased response, ability to fight off this particular strain. We don't know that for sure yet. And so we're watching this very, very closely. This variant has not been detected in the United States. Again, currently there's no evidence that these variants cause any more severe illness or increased risk of death, but when you're looking at viruses that have higher transmissibility, what that translates to is you've got higher transmissibility, so you're going to have a higher number of cases, and the more cases that you have, the more hospitalizations and deaths you're going to have, just by numbers, looking at the numbers. That really underscores the importance of ongoing rigorous compliance with the public health mitigation strategies that we talked about, including vaccination. Of course, that is our best tool in our toolbox right now, but of course it's limited. And so we're trying as hard as we can to get it out as quickly as possible. Just so everybody knows that public health officials are studying these variants. We're trying to learn as quickly as possible more about them and how to control their spread. And so as we get more information from CDC and other researchers, we will relay that information to Alaskans as quickly as we possibly can.
What is long COVID?
So long COVID is basically a term that's used to describe folks who have longer term signs and symptoms as a result of COVID infection. And so, you know, these symptoms can last weeks to months. And so there was a study that was just published in The Lancet, which looked at symptoms persisting in some people 6 months out after their original infection. These were primarily the study was in hospitalized people. Some of the most common signs and symptoms that people have are fatigue. That's a big one. Recurrent headaches can occur for folks. Just really feeling kind of run down. Hair loss can be an issue for about 20% of the people that were studied in that Lancet article that I mentioned. Some people will have persistence of loss of taste or smell, things like that. But maybe Dr. Hodges, is there more that you'd like to add to this?
We have seen this in the YK Delta. We have had multiple patients who have had prolonged symptoms of COVID. Interestingly enough, it has been my experience that it isn't really associated necessarily with the severity of the initial infection. Of course, I think it's a little more common if people are hospitalized and have a more serious infection, but we have also seen it in people who did not require hospitalization and felt relatively mildly ill to begin with. And that certainly has been a problem, and it affects people's quality of life greatly. And it just speaks again to the importance of prevention, because we often look at the death statistics associated with COVID, and we think that that's like the worst thing that could happen to you. And of course, that's a terrible thing. It is the worst thing that can happen to you when you're infected with COVID, but there are other things that can happen to you as well. And some people tend to think, well, this might just be a mild cold and I'll recover without any problems. And in most people, that is the case. But there is a smaller subset that will have this prolonged effect. And it does affect people's quality of life. So prevention is the key.
So, and I've just pulled up the CDC's webpage on long COVID. I'll just relay some of the other long-term symptoms that are commonly reported. I mentioned fatigue, shortness of breath, cough. People oftentimes will have a persistent cough that can last weeks to months. Joint pain can be a complication that lasts for a while, chest pain. Other reported symptoms include difficulty with thinking and concentration, sometimes called brain fog, depression, so some of the mental health effects that can persist, and also some anxiety issues, muscle pain, as I mentioned, persistent headaches or recurrent headaches. Intermittent fever has been reported in some people. Also a fast beating or a pounding heart. And then more rarely, people can have even more severe or serious long-term complications, such as inflammation of the heart itself, problems with lung function. Also acute kidney injury can happen, rashes. We talked about hair loss, sleep issues, and then, other mood changes. But that really underscores the main point that Dr. Hodges just raised, which is prevention is key. You do not want to get COVID. Not only can COVID cause hospitalization and death, but it can also cause long-term consequences, which in some cases can be, very significant for folks.
We're coming up on almost 12 months of a lockdown, while people are really hoping that things will go, quote unquote, back to normal, is there a time that people can expect this? Or can you give any advice for people who are looking for some normalcy?
We're still on the high seas. And that's what I want everybody to know. It just takes a quick glance at the national case counts to see that we're still at very, very high levels of COVID activity throughout the country. Alaska has been fortunate over the last month to have a pretty precipitous decrease in our cases. We've now seen more of a leveling off and kind of a bump again in cases. And that could be a harbinger of what's to come. We may see increased case counts in the weeks ahead. We want to do whatever we can to get people vaccinated as quickly as possible, because as I said, that is the best tool that we have in our toolbox to fight COVID is vaccination. These vaccines are highly effective, 95% effective, which is remarkable. They're also very safe. They've got a very good safety profile. So it will largely depend on how quickly we are able to get people vaccinated. And the quicker we're able to do that, the quicker we're going to get COVID behind us. And especially now with these new strains that are emerging, it's just so important that we get people vaccinated as quickly as possible so we decrease that pressure on the virus to mutate and change. And so the question is when? When can we expect to be back to normal? Nobody knows the answer to that right now. I think that things are going to be very, very different. Probably by late spring, when we get quite a lot of people vaccinated, I think our case counts will go down pretty significantly. And it could be as early as early summer when we start to see some semblance of normalcy come back to us here in Alaska. But again, a lot of it just depends on vaccine uptake and how quickly we're able to get the vaccine out. So just really want to encourage folks, if you're hesitant about the vaccine, to talk to your healthcare provider about it if you still have questions. So far, we've seen really good safety profile. There have been millions and millions of doses that have been administered across the country and really globally. So there's definitely, even though we're still on the high seas, there's a light on the horizon. And that sun is continuing to rise.
We were having a call one time a few days ago with villages, and one of the village elders said he had the feeling that it would be by the fall. He thought things might get back a little bit more normal, especially for our kids back in school and everything, by about the fall. And that felt about right to me. And I agree. As the sun starts to come back, a little bit more hope. But the more people we can vaccinate, the more people who can adhere to our public health recommendations of mask wearing and keeping their social circles small, the faster we're going to get to that point. So I cannot emphasize that enough, especially since we can't vaccinate our children. So we have to vaccinate all the adults we possibly can to surround our children in a cocoon of people who have been vaccinated to keep them safe and to protect them and get them back into school. We have a lot of work to do, and we've got to get through this winter. And we got to get as many people vaccinated as we possibly can. And people still have to wear their masks and socially distance and wash their hands.
Definitely. So we got to listen to the rules and get vaccinated. Speaking of vaccinations again, Dr. McLaughlin, there's a few new vaccines that are in late trials that will be available to the public soon. Do you have any information that you can give us on those?
Sure. So there are two vaccines that are on the horizon that hopefully will be coming out and made available in the United States soon. One is made by Johnson & Johnson, and the other is made by AstraZeneca. And these are they're different than the mRNA vaccines. They're called viral vector vaccines. And basically what happens is they take a virus that is not capable of replicating in the human body. And they basically use that virus as a Trojan horse. It basically comes in with that mRNA that we've got with these mRNA viruses, that little snippet of our mRNA that codes for the spike protein that we talked about. And this virus enters into our cells just the way other viruses do, and it goes into the cell and activates the machinery. So it's It's very similar in concept to the mRNA vaccine, but instead of having the mRNA encoded or encased in a little lipid nanoparticle, which is the case with these mRNA vaccines, it's just encased in a virus that doesn't have the capacity to replicate or cause illness itself. So, you know, one of the promising things about, for example, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, as we mentioned, is, you know, it's intended to be a single dose vaccine. That could change. They've added a little bit to their clinical trial. They've added an arm that's looking at a second dose. But if it is, in fact, a one dose vaccine, that will really be quite helpful. And then also, these vaccines don't have the cold storage issues that we have with these mRNA vaccines. So it's going to be a lot easier to get these vaccines out throughout Alaska, especially some of our more rural communities.
That's about all the time we have for today. I'd like to thank Dr. Joe McLaughlin and Dr. Ellen Hodges for taking time out of their busy schedules to talk with us about all of these new COVID advancements. And I'd also like to thank Tammy Coburn for helping me to organize all of this and for just being a great source of information for everyone. This is an advancement that has happened after the recording of this episode, but as of Friday, January 15th in the afternoon, all YK residents over the age of 16 are eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. If you're interested in being considered for vaccination, fill out the form that can be found at ykhc.org. This form will also be linked in the online posting of this episode. If you cannot fill out this form, call the COVID hotline at 543-6949 or call your local clinic to schedule an appointment. Again, if you have any questions, you can contact me directly at elle@kyuk.org. And if you have any questions about COVID in the YK Delta, visit ykhc.org. And for questions about all things Alaska COVID, please visit covid19.alaska.gov. Thanks, everyone. Stay healthy, stay safe, and don't forget to wash your hands. Thank you for listening to Wellness Wednesday, a show about health and wellness in the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. Catch us every Wednesday at 10 a.m. right here on KYUK.